I'm Christopher Lydon, back in the pub with Mark Blyth, the know-it-all professor with the Sean Connery accent. Mark, we need political economists when the political economy of energy is screaming red alert, from the nuclear knockout in Japan to this Arab revolt in the oil zone, which has gone, since I've seen you, from the Arab Spring to civil war in Libya. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. Good to see you again, Mark. This is not the 2011 you told us to worry about. What happened?
It is the 2011. It's just got a few added wrinkles.
You told us austerity was the worst thing that could happen in 2011 and we'd get through it.
And it's still going on, and it's going to get more strict, and there's going to be more austerity. So that part of the prediction, such as it's worth, is still holding true. Now, here's the interesting thing. Japanese earthquakes, tsunamis, and nuclear reactors as a trifecta, you're not going to see that coming. Here's an interesting one. Exactly the same excuses that are being offered now for why the CIA couldn't see Egypt coming are not only redolent of the same ones that they offered when they couldn't see Iran coming all that time ago, It's exactly the same arguments that you got for why you couldn't see the mortgage crisis coming and the financial meltdown coming. And you know the funny thing is, there's a real commonality between all these things. They're inherently unpredictable events. They're generated by systems of complexity, not by any one factor. So you can tell a story that says something like, all this stuff in Egypt, it really starts off in Queensland, because in Queensland they had a flood or a famine or whatever it was. And then that reduced the supply of wheat, and then this filters all the way through to these countries, and then you have bread riots. One cause, one effect, and then everything's explained. What's going on here is something in Nassim Taleb, and I have written a paper about, called The Black Swan of Cairo, which is coming out in the next issue of Foreign Affairs, which essentially argues that the problem with banking systems and dictatorships is essentially similar. It's called constrained volatility. You take all of the risk in the world and you stuff it under the carpet and beat it down, whether it's political risk or financial risk. And when systems like that stay stable for a long time, we mistake that stability for permanence. And we go, oh, look, it hasn't blown up yet. It must be safe. Therefore, whether we're performing risk calculations that are utterly meaningless in the financial sector or plotting dictatorships for maintaining stability in a perilous region, all we're actually doing is fattening up the turkey for the inevitable Thanksgiving that's coming along. The only thing is, no one ever told us what date Thanksgiving falls on, and that's why you get surprised.
But hold it right there. You mentioned the black swans of Nassim Taleb. Black swan meaning an unpredictable event, could be 9/11, could be exploding underwater oil wells in the Gulf of Mexico. We don't see them coming, but we then create a whole mythology of meaning around what may be unexplainable anyway.
Absolutely. Well, I'll give you a story on this one. So imagine Iran. So in Iran, you basically do this thing where you have a guy called the Shah. And the Shah's your bad guy, or your good guy, bad guy. And to keep the place stable, he basically kills all the communists. And then he drives the left into exile. Then he bans trade unions, or tries to. And he eviscerates the Democrats and castrates the liberals. And then after a while, the only place you can have a conversation is in the mosque, and the inevitable result is Khomeini. That's a post-facto story that makes sense from all the available bits. It's not what happened, because you can't see that until it comes along and bites you. The only time you know risk is exposed is when the risk is actually exposed. Until that time, right before, just as Lehman Brothers was stable, just as Egypt was stable, just as Iraq and Iran were both stable, that stability is, how can I put it, not what it seems. So these black swan prone environments, if you want to put it that way, low probability, very hard to detect, high impact events, tend to happen in systems where any and all volatility has been swept under the carpet. And the consequence of that is that when they blow up catastrophically.
Taleb's whole point in that wonderful book, The Black Swan, and you touted it to me, was precisely, though, that we're in a more and more tightly networked world where these things are bound to happen. An earthquake and a tsunami in Japan immediately affects the whole world's planning for energy resources.
And stock markets and everything else. Instant impact, absolutely.
On a political economist's Richter scale, how big are these events that have sort of overtaken what felt like a great year coming in 2011?
Well, I never thought it was a great year. I thought it was going to be a lousy year because of austerity politics, and we still see that in Wisconsin and other places.
I thought it was a great year coming when Tunisia and then Egypt made these heroic deep shifts of direction.
But there's the interesting thing. If you have, let me give you a counterexample. Let's think about a country like Italy. So in Italy, you've had about 60 governments in 50 years. And now we've got the scandal with Berlusconi. Mm. And before that, we had the scandal with Benito Craxi. And before that, we had a scandal with people we've forgotten about. And through all of that, GDP's risen, and the Italian countryside is pacific, and everybody goes there on vacation, and they make great wine. All of the risks are exposed. All of the players are known. The worst jump that can ever happen is from the Social Democrats to the Conservatives, from the Lega Lombardi to the Communists. And they're all in bed with each other anyway. So in those types of systems, you can have all the tight coupling you want, but how far the regime can jump from one to another is very constrained. Mm. When you take something like Egypt or a Tunisia, where you've taken all of the dissidents and all of the volatility in the system and swept it under the carpet, when it goes bang, there's no telling where it ends up. So the very thing that we're applauding, what we're immediately doing is doing that story that we did about how Khomeini was inevitable or how the mortgage crisis was inevitable. We're all Monday morning quarterbacks, and we're Monday morning quarterbacking and the pass is still in the air. We have no idea where the stuff's going to end up. In a year from now, we might well be cursing Egypt.
So interesting you mentioned Italy. It immediately comes to mind a line from W.H. Auden. There's no country in the world that seems as impervious in its deep life, as you say, wine, women, song, opera, beauty, etc., impervious to technology and politics. Those things just a little tiny wave. But there are other countries, too, including Japan, which are on the very edge of technological fragility. Mm-hmm. So how do you read the danger or the significance in these countries that are so disruptible by technology and politics?
Again, it's not so much the politics and let's put technology aside, that could mean anything in this context. They're disruptible because they're highly constrained systems. That is to say, all dissent, all volatility, all protest has been squashed for so long. Add together with that demographics, which are very, very focused on a young population. It's just a question of time until it cracks. But you can't tell when it's going to crack. It's a bit like sort of saying, okay, we know the bridge is unsound. We know that eventually a truck's going to go over it that's going to knock it off. And then when it finally happens, you blame the truck. No, it's the system. It's not the truck.
Where does the austerity problem, where does Wisconsin, where does Irish debt play in this world that seems to have been transformed by these energy shocks?
I don't see it being transformed yet. I mean, basically, these core countries, the United States, the European Union, still have these serious problems. They've convinced themselves that they have massive budget problems and they have to retrench them. As I said on NPR last Sunday, how on earth beating up on unions who constitute 10% of the American workforce, who get paid low wages anyway, that's why they're in unions. Why beating up on them is going to be the solution to the federal budget crisis or local budget crisis, I have no idea. That's a whole school of voodoo economics I didn't think existed. But nonetheless, those projects, political as they are to the core, are going to continue. What's happening in Libya, what's happening in Egypt is amazing and transformative. The directionality of that is we don't know. We don't know what that's going to transform into. And as for Japan, what's happening there, let's consider how this tightly coupled system works. The minute anybody says nuclear, everyone freaks out because they have images of meltdown and radiation. And then you have the historical legacy of the only country that's actually been nuked in a war, and this is where it's happening, and so on and so forth. So global stock markets fall off a cliff in a way they haven't done since 2008. Then what happens? Well, it turns out that actually it might not be that bad. And with a little bit of bailey wire and string and water from a fire cannon and so on and so forth, they might actually manage to get the coolant systems working again. And if they do, there's been some radiation leakage, but it's not a catastrophic meltdown. And a simple way to do this, it sounds harsh, but think about it this way. Every year around the world, there's probably tens of thousands of people who are killed coal mining. And then there's a bunch of people who might be maimed 20 years down the line by the radiation from this accident. Okay, how do you adjudicate that in a balance? Are we going to ban coal mining because more people were killed in that than maybe killed in this incident? So what's fundamentally transformative about this? We still have a global warming problem. If we're going to basically do what Angela Merkel did to appeal to basically the green constituents in Germany, simply throwing, if you will, green meat to the base, let's switch off all the nuclear power plants. Okay, that's great. What's your next trick? Are we now going to burn more Russian gas? Or are we just going to not have lighting and heating for 2 months of the year? How's that one going to work out for you, angler? So to the extent that these things are transformative, yeah, okay, in the moment they seem very, very important. Japan basically blew up 40% of its GDP in the 1930s and bounced back. We nuked them twice, they bounced back. They're bouncing back from this. Anybody who's shorting Japan just now, I'll take the long side of the trade.
Hmm. So now you're going to sell us some good news of the civil war in Libya.
No, I'm not, because I don't know what's going on there, and neither does anyone else. And we know what's really interesting about this. This is what I do find truly interesting about it. You go back just 20 years, right? You think about Tiananmen Square, right? Which is 20 years ago, more or less. And you have the pictures of the guy standing in front of the tank, which has become emblematic. Mm. And you have the media's ability to suppress what's going on. And we don't really know how many students disappeared to this day and so on and so forth. And then China basically weathers the storm and emerges okay. And then once they start growing again, nobody really cares. And it's all been forgotten about. There's something different now, and this is about the technology of interconnectivity. This is about social media. This is about demographics in the world. People are connected in such a way now that you kind of can't get away with that, that everything is known. There's too many possible sources of information for people to speak out. There's camera phones, mobiles, everything that show you things that you couldn't see before. So every now and again, you'll get a place like Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, where they'll have the riots in 2005 that try and create some kind of revolutionary situation, and you have a real mother of a crackdown there because you just don't have too much global media embedded there. But if you have an Al Jazeera plus Twitter plus Facebook, it's really hard to clamp down on this. You can shut down the internet, as they did in some of these countries, and it still doesn't work. So there's something in this which is really different. And the way I like to think about it is, it's not that people have changed. They've always been greedy. They've always been angry. They've always been pissed off about one thing or another. But the environment's changed. There's something in the world now, almost as a quasi-physical thing, a norm that says you just can't do this anymore. And the reason you can't do this anymore is because we can see it. And because we can see it, it's basically that David Hume, the philosopher, talked about this a long time ago. And in philosophy, it's sometimes known as the problem of Hume's little finger. And he says, if I were to cut off the end of my little finger, I would feel more than that than I would for the death of 10,000 Chinamen, because it is remote to me. I can hear it, but I can't feel it. Mm. Well, you can see Libya. You can feel it. You actually understand in your heart what's going on there. You get the fact that, for me, this is a very personal one on some level. There was a foreign policy elite defector from Libya who basically said about a week ago now, well, I can show you the evidence that this guy planned the Lockerbie bombing. Well, that came down in Scotland. You know, that had an impact where I lived, let alone the 270 people or thereabouts who were on the Pan Am flight that went down. This guy's an international terrorist. Let's call it what it is. We've been kissing up to him for years, which is why the people who have been doing so are now rightly ashamed of themselves. But again, there's Monday morning quarterbacking in that. A couple of years ago, we were bringing Libya back into the cold, in from the cold. They'd given up their nuclear program. They were the example of the terrorist state that made good.
Tony Blair, ever a barometer, was out there embracing it.
Never mind sort of, there's various, academic institutions around the world who aren't looking too good for the way they've been cozying up to the Libyans.
Not to mention London School of Economics, yes.
I'm not mentioning them at all. But imagine this. Imagine that China tries another Tiananmen. What's going to happen to all of the elite institutions in the United States that's been opening up campuses all over there? Are they going to get the same treatment as the LSE? Are we all going to Monday morning quarterback these guys as well? So the judgment on this is interesting. There's something in the world that says you can't do that now, and in a sense, we're compelled to act. That's why the French and the British got the Americans over a barrel. They felt they had to do it. After the Bosnia, where they completely failed, they couldn't have another foreign policy disaster on their doorstep, particularly because it means 1 million Libyans getting on boats and going to Italy. They really want to avoid that. So they had to. But it's not reducible to the strategic actions. It's not reducible to oil. There's a moral component to that. And that's why Obama felt compelled to get in, because if he didn't get on the boat on that, what does this guy really stand for?
Is he on the boat yet? Isn't it our boat anyway? How does that play?
Well, your boat's certainly firing the missiles and coordinating the air attacks, but you got all bent out of shape about the fact that it was the French that launched the first airstrikes and they hadn't fully informed everyone and no one quite knows where this is going to end and so on and so forth. You know, but there's a lesson here from what we did before. Let's go back to this analogy of hyper-constrained systems, right? So imagine Saddam, right? Let's think about the constraint involved in this. This guy's no different from what the Shah was. He was our thug. So he kills the communists, drives out the left, and bans the Democrats, and blah, 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 and you don't even have the mosque as a space. And he basically is the master of all you can see. He then crosses us. We don't like it. We put him in a box with sanctions for 10 years and reduce his nation to poverty and governed by violence and terror. Excellent. Now, when we invade that place, we kind of walk in and expect it to jump from that to being something like, oh, I don't know, France. Right, that's going to be the regime that's going to pop out of that. Some fully formed democracy. Now, places like Egypt haven't been nearly as oppressive in a macro sense as places such as Iran and Iraq were under their dictatorships. But nonetheless, these are not pleasant regimes. We don't know how Libya is going to work out. We don't know how Egypt's going to work out. Simple as that. So does Obama own this? Nobody owns this. We were compelled to act without a compelling reason that's grounded in any standard conception of state's interests, other than the fact that we had to.
Two last probes from me, Mark Blythe. Scoop yourself as much as you dare from your foreign affairs piece. What does it mean that we have these new, incredibly important black swans seeming to confirm that this is the pattern? Unpredictable global, instant global crisis is the rule of the day.
Yeah, but let's not get too bent out of shape about it, because complex systems, while they're tightly coupled and are black swan prone if all the volatility is packed and, you know, shoved under the carpet, so to speak, and then they become prone to these explosions, we also have a remarkable capacity to bounce back. Listening about what happened with Japan, you had the trifecta from hell, right? First, you have an earthquake, 9.0. All right, so let's follow up with a tsunami, and then let's have a nuclear accident. And what happens? Global stock markets fall off a cliff. And a week later, they're back. And the Japanese look like they might actually just pull this off. Why? Because they are a very technologically advanced society, because they've got more experience with nuclear energy than anyone else, and because we got lucky. Let's face facts, it could have been a lot worse still. So we might get away with that. Now, what's the lesson we're going to take from that? Being humans, we'll probably learn too much, which is to say, well, that shows that nuclear power is safe. No, it's not. We've got a 60-year track record, and we've been lucky so far. Doesn't mean we're not turkeys looking for Thanksgiving once again. So we become more tightly coupled, there will be more black swan events, but our capacity to bounce back is always there. It's not simply a question of any and all volatility should be allowed to rip. That will tear through the system and create its own problems. It's certainly not the case that we should always try to intervene and guard against anything because we don't want to risk anything at all. But you don't want to get in a position whereby what you're saying is don't touch anything ever, don't try anything ever, because it'll end up creating some kind of downstream consequence you can't calculate. Some of those consequences might be good. Let me give you an example of this. Long time ago, back in the 19th century, before they had a fully formed notion of how diseases were transmitted through bacteria and viruses, etc., there was a theory of disease that said it travelled on the wind. It was smell. And it was the stench that really made you sick. Hence why the Victorians were always running out to get good air and all this sort of stuff and going to the countryside and all that, right? You know, hence the words airs and graces and all that sort of stuff, right? So this is what they were doing. Now, they were completely wrong, but one of the things that they did, because they were obsessed with smell, was to build sewers. Now, that was exactly the right thing to do had you had the proper theory of disease. But it was the wrong theory of disease. They thought it was about smell. So they got the smell and they literally got the shit off the streets and put it underground. And in doing so, they made the biggest advance in public health ever, for all the wrong reasons. Sometimes non-linearities work out in a really good way. So you don't want to kill the good stuff with the bad stuff.
We've learned again that no problems ever get solved. They just get overwhelmed and pushed off page one by much bigger, different kinds of problems. But go back to what you were worried about in 2011. Since we've seen you, the Irish did vote out the government that saddled everybody with sovereign debt for the sins of a few speculative investors. That was going to bring the euro down. That was going to bring the world economy down. What now?
Well, the euro problem is still there. It's fascinating what's going on, because the Europeans are just playing this wonderful game of kick the can further down the road and hope nobody notices. Mm. So the original bailout mechanism they had was basically a big bag of money with the words 250 billion on it. And they've now increased it to 500, which basically tells me that's how much you're willing to lose. Right, you're all willing to lose. Your bailout fund is 500 billion. You basically walked up to the craps table with 500, and you've told me how much you're willing to play. Now, that's going to bail out Ireland if they get into trouble again. It's going to bail out Portugal. There's no way it's going to bail out Spain. So you've basically just told me you're not willing to bail out Spain. Congratulations, you've just made the situation worse. The new bailout mechanism subordinates existing sovereign debt into what's called junior status. Now, what does this actually mean? It means that rather than the bailout fund being used to buy distressed bonds from bondholders who would be otherwise dumping their bonds and causing the bank run that's going to bring down the euro, which is what you should do, right? Secondary market purchases. What they're doing is only buying from the primary dealer. Well, the primary dealer is the state. So in other words, this new bailout mechanism is going to be used when things are really, really bad to buy more crappy bonds in exchange for another loan to keep the same thing going. It's kicking the can down the road. They haven't solved anything. So I'm still extremely bearish on the future of the euro. And austerity politics is going to continue. And all those underlying trends are trending in one direction. Look at British confidence and economic growth figures in the last quarter. They're going down. They're going south. It's not getting better.
And what about the American can? Where does that go in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
I think Wisconsin's very interesting because what you're seeing now with things like, so let's take away collective bargaining rights and let's take money away from NPR, is exactly what I thought would happen in terms of the way the Republicans riding on the momentum of the Tea Party would perform themselves. They're not actually going to turn around and put the mortgage interest tax deduction on the block. They're not actually going to say, okay, now we really need to sit down and everybody's Social Security check needs to get cut in half. You can take out every discretionary program in the federal budget and you still can't balance the budget. So these guys aren't even serious. So what is this? This is politics by other means. Who do we like to pick on? The poor and the unions. Fine, let's give them a good kicking once again. And then once we've done that, we'll move on to other projects. But as for getting serious about the supposed problems, it's not going to happen. Let's remember this. The United States is $14 trillion in debt. It's a $14 trillion economy, which means it's levered up 1-to-1. If I have a mortgage and the bank lends me 3 times my income, I'm levered up 3-to-1. How come it's okay for me, a single person, to have a debt-to-GDP ratio of 300%, whereas the United States government, who's about to get more money than God can think of come April the 15th, because it actually creates an income stream from its taxpayers, gets levered up 1-to-1 and everybody starts crying, the sky is falling. The United States is a few percentage points off of its net debt position of being able to join the euro. Let me say that again. Please. The United States' net debt position is almost strong enough to qualify for joining the euro. A 60% debt to GDP ratio when you do it on the net and not on the gross figures. And the gross figures, really, in comparative perspective, aren't even that big. So we have a moral panic about a morality of budget balancing that has no economic rationale, that is never going to go anywhere because no one's seriously going to cut Social Security because it's political suicide.
Mark Blythe, the sage of Glasgow, so happy that you're living these days at the Watson Institute. Thank you. We're all confused, but at a higher level than when you walked in.
And as usual, I will shine off on my Sean Connery accent and just say, well, Chris, it's always been a pleasure. I've got to go because Spectre's after me. Goodbye.
Thank you. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.